Succession number 11214, Reel 2.
Colonel Jourdain, Reel 2. I wonder if we could talk now a little about this signalling course you went on at the Curragh. What level of seriousness was it?
Oh, it was, for those days, sort of accepted level, which was Morse code in flags. I can't remember the proper name for it. Ordinary flags. I mean, this kind of thing. And semaphores, a separate subject. And the D3 telephone with a buzzer on it, Morse code on that. The course was taken by two cavalry officers who wore beautiful uniforms, and they were quite nice, but in fact, it was really run by about three NCOs. And I only learnt afterwards that if I'd paid the three NCOs either 10 shillings each or won 10 shillings and didn't bother to do much work. But one learnt the Morse code properly there. That's really what it amounted to. And the use of that universal thing, the D3 telephone. The D3 telephone was a small cubic thing about so big, which had a buzzer on it and a telephone. And that was a staple machine in France later on when was there. One learnt those, and then one went back to the regiment at Kinsale. Very soon after that.
Can I just ask, how did you get on with the officers of your battalion? Besides the colonel, I mean, how did you get on together?
We all seemed to get on very well. I don't quite know why. I mean, I wasn't an Irishman. I was one. I'd only probably about the only chap there who'd been to an English public school. There may have been one or two more, particularly among the older people. Everybody was very nice. I think they were nicer in an Irish regiment. They either accepted you or they didn't. That was going along. That went all through it, I think, and at the front. I've never regretted going to that regiment. People helped you, and there was no excessive ambition or anything like that.
What about, had any of the officers been at the front?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. A small number of people had been at the front in 1914 and possibly 1915 and had come back, probably could have been wounded or something of that sort. And looking back on it, one never felt able to ask them what the front was like or anything about it, nor did they talk about it. I think they were so relieved to get away from it and also slightly apprehensive about being sent back to it again. They didn't want to be. That you learnt nothing from other people about the front. I'm very glad you asked that, and you'll find out why in a minute. One knew singly little about it at all, and what you would have learnt about was what happened in 1914 and in France, which, of course, very soon became out of date. I mean, chaps were literally going about with swords on in France from there to. But one didn't, and one's conscious of the fact that one didn't, and that one, not only one didn't, one couldn't.
Would you, which of the off, were, was, you said the commanding officer wasn't much in evidence. Who then would be doing the sort of day-to-day running? Was it the adjutant?
The adjutant was a promoted ranker, a very good chap, who'd got wounded, badly wounded, with a bayonet through his cheek, I think, in 1914. And had come home, you see, and had been given this job as adjutant of this very large reserve battalion at Kinsale. They ran the show, but you saw very little of them.
What about the senior subaltern?
There was a chap in those days always called the senior subaltern. And I think you had to salute him in the morning. And you certainly had to say good morning to him. And he was exactly like a senior prefect or something at school. And he was quite a decent chap.
What about mess life?
The mess life was quite pleasant, except for this one thing. They had a guest night every Friday night, at which there never seemed to be any guests. But you could never leave before the senior officer left, and that would normally be, on the average, 2 a.m. Well, now, as a second lieutenant, you could probably afford one whiskey and soda or something after dinner. and make that, not in one, one didn't want anymore, but you've got to make that last out for about 2 o'clock, because you could not leave until the senior officer left. And these, they're mostly rather old chaps from our point of view, they liked nattering away, you see, and we didn't, we had no joy at all out of it. And that happened once a week, no guests.
Was the battalion a hard-drinking battalion amongst the officers? I mean, was there a...
Irishmen tend to be hard drinkers, but there was certainly not any drunkenness, which is the thing that matters. No, I don't know about drunkenness at all.
Did they have any sort of mess traditions or mess games?
No, not much, fortunately. I don't. Signals had more of that, I think, later on, but I've hardly been at home in that matter. But singing and that sort of thing. It was quite mild and harmless, and it went on so long.
You said fortunately. That sort of side of things wasn't to your taste.
Oh, Lord, no. Boring in the extreme.
Were there rules about what could and couldn't be discussed in the mess?
Yes, religion. I suppose religion, remember, it's a mixed regiment, Catholic and Protestant. It never seemed to worry anybody, but it wasn't. I forget what else. Women, isn't it?
Would they discuss military matters in the mess, or would that be taboo?
Do you mean sort of serious military matters?
Yes.
No, I don't think so. No, just local affairs, I think. I don't think there wasn't much discussion of the regiment abroad or anything like that. So by that time, the 1st Battalion was in Mesopotamia, and you heard very little from them, about them. The 2nd Battalion had walked into Germany in about September 1914, if not in August, and were disbanded. End. So there's no 2nd Regular Battalion in existence, and the rest were at home. I mean, incidentally, Irish regiments had 2 reserve battalions. I don't quite know why. There's a 3rd and a 4th, and the 4th was somewhere else, somewhere near Cork. But they had no territorial battalions.
Were you able to manage on your salary, or did you have to use some of your private means to...
Well, I had no private means, like most of us. And we seemed to get by all right without running into debt. It was 7 and 6 a day then. There were certain things like rations, I mean physical rations. Well, not much else, I don't think. But I don't remember being hard up, or particularly so.
Did you enjoy the life?
I think I did, there. But one was... You know, there was a certain amount of excitement, you see. There was this marching around Southern Ireland. And, the spin-offs from the row in Dublin, the 1916 row in Dublin, you see, that was affecting life to a certain extent. And I wasn't in Kinsale very long. In fact, I was only there from the end of January to July.
Now, how did you... Were you looking forward to going to France, or were you apprehensive? Or?
That's what people would say is a good question. I was certainly not apprehensive... I was certainly keen to get into the adventure. And suddenly, one fine day, my number came up. And I realised, I think retrospectively, I was very pleased, because I was 18 and a bit, and somebody had brought out an order then that nobody who was under 19 was to go to the front. And anyway, I went to the front. with one or two... No, with... Perhaps a few other subalterns. I went home on leave and then came back and went out to France.
Would you rather have gone... You were picked, you joined the 6th Service Battalion on the Western Front, because there was the possibility of being sent out to Mesopotamia. Or how would you have felt if you had been sent?
Well, I'm very glad I wasn't, because I think the Mesopotamia, tropics and all that were not my cup of tea at all. And that was, I think, regular battalions, and when I met them later on in France, were pretty awkward as social entities. I mean, you were very much a new boy and that kind of thing. But these service battalions, which meant the greater majority of battalions in France, were quite new and were much more pleasant, I think, to join. Anyway, I was quite glad I wasn't sent to Mesopotamia. But this is quite true. I don't know whether I put it in that before. Of the subalterns who went to Etarp, which is where everybody went to in those days, there were perhaps, we'll say, 10 of us. Half went to these something in Enniskillen Fusiliers. The other half went to the something else in Enniskillen Fusiliers, I mean another battalion, because they were short of officers. And FWSJ, for some odd reason, was told to go to the 2nd Battalion somewhere else, and I tried to find out where somewhere else was, and it was in Salonika. So that struck me as being a bit odd, and I had some gumption then. I formed up and went in the ordinary and said, "Sir, do you really want me to go to Salonika?" And they said, "What are you talking about?" And cut a long story short, I said, "I'd very much like to be sent to the 6th Connaught Rangers." So out of this bunch of officers, I was the only one who went to a Connaught Rangers battalion in France, and that suited me down to the ground. And I did. And
When you left Ireland, were you given any briefing as to what kit or equipment you should take as an officer going to the Western Front?
Absolutely none. And you didn't feel like asking. I mean, it sounds silly, but I mean, you put your finger on a good point. I went without any pyjamas because I thought once you got there, the war was going on and you joined and it never stopped. That is historically true. But fortunately, we went to a place called Etarp, which you've probably heard of since, which was the infantry base depot, where you always stood about for a bit before you went to a battalion or somewhere else. And obviously had an opportunity of buying some pyjamas then. One was so innocent, so green.
What you went to Etarp, and we've discussed how you went to the 6th, and you asked to go. Did you do any actual training while you were at Etarp?
Yes, no. There were a number of very brutal NCOs who were put in charge of all the second lieutenants who came out to put them through a bayonet fighting course. Very useful, I can assure you. Stabbing dummies with bayonets with appalling language from the instructors. And that's all. But, I mean, it was stupid. I mean, it was simply marking time, or rather wasting time, just doing this bayonet fighting and nothing else. No lectures on what the front was really like.
Yeah, this bayonet course, did you think that at the time, as you were going through the course, did you think it was a waste of time?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, as an officer, one wouldn't normally be doing bayonet fighting, even in the front, in the line.
And you say it was a particularly brutal NCO in the language. Could you enlarge on that a bit more?
Well, I mean, you were running at dummies and sticking them with a bayonet. And they would encourage you to be violent or to be brutal about it with a lot of violent and brutal language, as simple as that. Which they probably thought you might be a bit timid about sticking a bayonet into somebody. I think that was the idea, that unless you made people feel pretty brutal and violent, you would never, never, never stick a bayonet into a Boche. You never, never, never would likely to have the occasion to do it, I might mention either, particularly as an officer.
Did they expect you to use this brutal language and shouting as you did it?
Only grunting, probably, or something of that sort. Not more than that. No, it was simply, I don't know, it was a waste of time.
What about, that's all the training you did while you were there?
Yes, and the whole thing was curious. I mean, there were a lot of very old colonels, chaps with crown and two stars and blue tabs, commanding the place, and they had the remotest notion of what the war was like or what they really should do with people, except to try and avoid a mutiny through boredom. And, of course, they got it later on, didn't they?
Yes, in 1917. Did you see how the troops were being trained? I mean, while you were there, you were the officers, but did you have any idea of...
They're probably with them. I don't know. They were small squad, not large numbers. I can't really remember. I couldn't give an honest answer to that.
Was there any atmosphere of unrest while you were there? It's a long
No. You mean this recent thing about the mutiny at Etarp?
Yes, I mean, was it were people reasonably satisfied at the camp?
I think so. And what's more, once one left that place and gone up to the front proper, you never had any connection with it again, because if you went on leave from the front, you went from the front to the ports. You didn't go to Etarp on the way. And I've no idea how much truth there is in mutinies and things down there later on, which one's heard about. But I've only heard about it in the last 10 years or less.
When you joined the 6th Battalion, where were they at that time?
They were in the line at Loos, and the base details or whatever they were at a place called Nerlemien. I don't know if you want to put that down. It's N-O-E-U-E-X. I mean, never mind. They were there. And the battalion, which was the front, said, send this chap or these chaps, I think it was only this chap, on a bayonet fighting course. That was a little local thing, that's all. And I did just that. But all the time, I was asking people, what is a shell? I had no idea what a shell was. It shows you how little one learnt about the war in Kinsale. Absolutely nothing. any rate, I did not know what a shell was. But then, of course, on Tuesday, and if I got there on Sunday, a shell arrived in Nurley. I mean, I was quite clear as to what a shell was for the rest of the war, because the thing went off bang in no uncertain way in Nurley.
When you joined, this was another bayonet fighting course you were put on when you got there, was it?
I suppose so, yeah. But did I have on a bayonet fighting course before?
You had a bayonet fighting course at Etarps.
Oh, I see, yes, that's quite...
Is that the same one?
No, it's not the same one. The bayonet fighting was at Etarps, that's all right. But did I say it was a bayonet fighting course when I joined?
Yes.
No, I must have made a mistake there.
No, that's not a problem. So, do you know which, by any chance, which company you were attached to of the six when you got there?
Not offhand, no.
Doesn't matter.
Because you see, there were a lot of companies in those days. I mean, about eight, weren't there, I think.
So, what were your first impressions then on arrival? You told us about the shell. What were you put on doing when you got there?
That was at Nurley Mean, which is in the reserve position. I mean, it was above ground. I mean, you walked about in Nurley Mean, but the shells did occasionally arrive there. Oh, well, yes, that's right. I was put on a bayonet fighting course there, quite definitely. That's right, I remember now. But that was some quite trivial thing. But then the next thing is the battalion came out of the line. They were in for about a week in, week out, something like that, to a place called Mazengarb, I think, which is halfway between Nurley Mean and the line. And I actually joined them when they came out of the line that time. And, of course, I had to go and touch my hat to the commanding officer. The commanding officer was a very fine chap. He was a regular officer. Have I said all this before?
No.
Who had commanded the 2nd Battalion of the Connaught Rangers, the regular one, in peacetime, up till 1912, from some time before that, when a company quartermaster sergeant ran off with the money, as occasionally happened those days in all regiments, and went to America. The net result was that the commanding officer was there and then put on retired pay, which is really pretty rough. And he was a fine man. He was put on retired pay. And then when the war happens about 2 years after that, he is given a service battalion to form and take to France.
And this was Lieutenant Colonel Lennox Cunningham.
Cunningham. Mm-hmm.
And what kind of a man was he? What was your...
Oh, very dignified and austere. I mean, old school and all that, of senior officers. And, I mean, when they were out of the line, you know, they're into the line and out of the line weeks and fortnights, you had to go, if you were orderly officer out of the line, you had to go and report to the commanding officer that every evening, or whoever it was every evening, said everything's all right. That kind of thing. Very much sort of 1912 stuff.
What was the job of an orderly officer, as you mentioned it?
Go around and see if the troops were in their billets or something of that sort, and that arms were properly stored or something of that kind. But something, this was always in that battalion, just at that time, a hangover from being a regular battalion. He was a regular CO. And the second in command was a very nice major who was what we call a militia major. I mean, he was probably the 3rd Connaught Rangers, but they're pretty near regulars because the militia people were. And so it was very like a regular battalion at that moment in time. And that moment in time was July 1916. And we were in the line several times. And then, of course, the Battle of the Somme had started by then. And then we got sent down to the Battle of the Somme.
I'll come back to the Somme. I'm quite interested. Did you actually have a period in the front line?
Yes.
Before this? What was your first impressions of the front line then? Can you remember when you first went in the loose?
Yes, this awful route march up through this long communication trench up to the front called Northern Up. And today, by today, I mean, within the last few years, I've seen that area, and there's a system when you could almost see the trench have been filled in. Then a long, long walk up to the front line, via the support line, then the front line, and the front line was a trench, literally like that, and in front of the trench was some barbed wire, and over there were the Germans, and they were about 200 or 300 yards away or something like that, and you wonder what they were like. And every now and again, some bloody fool in the German army would start a bombardment for no particular reason, and they'd shell with 5.9s and things like that for about an hour, and things were going off, not just going off bang, but I mean knocking the place about, knocking out of the place for about an hour, and one got very, very frightened. And it would normally pass off. Very few shells, of course, actually landed in the trench. And we sometimes replied, and sometimes not. And one got very frightened, because all one could do was just stand there, and your movements could only be about perhaps 100 yards that way or that way for your little bit of the front. And you hope to God that one of these things would not land in the trench. As long as they didn't land actually in the trench, even if they were quite close, they did no harm. But it was terrifying.
Would you actually take cover in the trench? I mean, would you lie down or... under one of these bombardments, I mean?
That's an interesting question. You couldn't... I suppose it was too muddy to lie down. At any rate, you didn't feel that you could lie down.
How did you control... I mean, you said you were frightened quite naturally.
Yes.
How did you control that as an officer with the responsibilities of setting an example to the both the NCOs and the men?
I don't remember ever feeling any difficulty in that. I mean, it sounds pompous, but I mean, it isn't that. It's one was so afraid of not of showing yourself as being windy that you didn't. But inside you felt pretty frightened. And of course, your radius or movement was pretty small. You can move a bit to the right or a bit to the left, and then you're in somebody else's patch.
Did more experienced officers or NCOs help you when you got into the front line for the first time at least?
Good question. The company commander was a chap, son of a solicitor in Cork, who had got the Military Cross earlier in the war, before I came out.
Do you remember his name? Sorry.
It'll come back. I'll try and get it later on if I can. It wasn't Callaghan, but it was a name, something like that. He had got the Military Cross and apparently got the Legion of Honour as well. Note the word apparently. And he was a good company commander. He was capable. I think he was brave. And he got wounded in the Battle of the Somme, I think, and disappeared. But he turned up again later in the war, and I'll come to that perhaps later.
Did he share his experience with you?
No. That's the curious thing. Nobody ever told you anything, really. I mean, they're quite pleasant about it, but you had to pick things up. He once caught me asleep in the front line, which I suppose I could have been shot, but I don't think he woke me up. I mean, as a boy, because one was a boy, it was very difficult to keep awake. I mean, there might be nothing happening at all, you see, but you're just standing in one little ditch. Anyhow, perhaps I better mention it now. That same chap, later on, he was made a tremendous fuss of by his father, still in Cork, when he got his Military Cross, perhaps perfectly legitimately. That went to his head, and by the time I'd got out to France, that must have been earlier in the war, he had acquired a Legion of Honour. That Legion of Honour turned out to be completely bogus, because he got into trouble later on in the war. He was with the RAF, I think, or whatever the flying corps, I suppose it was then. And one could never believe it, that this Legion of Honour, with the ribbon, had been there for about 2 years, was completely bogus. There were one or two other cases like that.
Would the NCOs give you any advice?
There was an old chap, I think he was a Lance Corporal, who was a Cumberland miner. What he was doing in this regiment, I don't know. But he was a very decent chap, and he would lead me by the hand, even to the extent of saying, "I'd like you to listen here, sir." And I'd listen here, sir, and hear the Germans tunnelling underneath. That kind of thing. But the soldiers accepted one, however green one was, and people like that were very decent. The NCOs were okay. There was a sort of belief in the divine right of officers in those days. I mean, I think one should say that. And we were only there for in this loose bit for, well, say, a month on the outside. And then, I got pushed into hospital for a week because I got trench fever almost as quickly as that. But I came out again pretty quick.
What were the symptoms you had for trench fever?
Fever, I suppose, violent headaches and things like that. But what got me out of that hospital pretty quick was the fact that they woke everybody up at 4 a.m., including lots of people who had been quite severely wounded and were just getting a bit of sleep, which I always thought was criminal. At any rate, I got pushed out of that, which was good for my soul, and sent to join the battalion, which by then had, only a month after I got out in front, gone down to the Somme, and I joined them at the Somme.
As the month at Loos was one of the few times you were actually static, I'd like to ask you some questions about the conditions of service there.
Yeah.
What kind of dugout would you have as an officer, if any?
The dugouts were of a certain depth. I don't quite know what. In the rear of the trench, I mean, there was the front of the trench like that with a parapet, and the trench here, and at the back was another sort of parapet called a parador, I think. And the dugouts in which we lived or slept tended to be there, which is odd, I think, because shells could come in like that. But anyway, it was like
had
that.
Had it been an old German line then?
No, I don't think so, no. No, it had been there since... I don't think they'd moved at all in the Battle of Loos. They were still very close to the Germans, of course, around there. We were quite close to the Germans and quite a stretch of front, in front of Loos and just north of it.
And was your dugout in the front line, or was it in the second line?
No, this was. If you were in the front line, you were in the front line, with sometimes a dugout there, if the front had been there for a long time, as it had then. And they were quite deep.
What did they look like? It's difficult to explain for a tape recorder, but could you...
Well, really, just a hole in the wall about two steps down. I mean, if the trench is like that, and that's the front of it, with a rather higher parallel, and this thing was usually like that. Not very satisfactory, because the shell could come in and go bang like that. But it depended on the local mud and soil conditions as to where there weren't many of them. But you did, if you were off duty and allowed to sleep, you went down no great depth, but just a few steps down, with rather better cover, fairish cover, and you did sleep. I mean,
what did it actually look like what were the dimensions when you actually got in?
Probably about the size of this room, and if that's the front or the back, and that's the back, and but not quite as wide as this, and perhaps about yes,
it's about. 10 foot square.
Yes, something like that.
And how much head do you have? Would you be ducking?
You step down here. I think you probably have to bend down a little bit.
So under 6 foot.
Yes.
And just earth walls.
Oh, yes, it was literally the word dug out is quite right. I mean, it's the wells that way were solid, that way they were solid, and here about. Half the depth was the trench. I mean, the front of the dugout opened into the trench, and the dugout itself was a bit below the level of the trench. Not necessarily so, because sometimes you get too much water in them.
Now, what would be in there, this bare box of shape? What, would you have any wire beds or anything like that? As officers, I mean.
There must have been, I think, because obviously it would lie on the floor. Probably a couple, you see. They might have. Because the front had been. By that time, the front had been there some time.
What about a table or chairs, things like that?
No, I don't think so. Not there.